Now it's time to chop it up with the one and only John Wilner. John knows all, tells all. You can find his content. You can follow him on social, over on Twitter, Wilner Hotline. Of course, his content's on sports360az.com. And he has the Wilner Canzano, I'll never say it the other way, podcast, because Johnny is with us every week.
I appreciate that.
Let's start, John, with Washington. I want to go with Washington right off the top because everybody's there's two things going on in talk shows today. One is Taylor Swift. We're not going to go there. The other is Dion.
I could get my daughter on if you would like to go there.
let's do a whole segment. John's daughter on Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. And the other one is Dion, and we'll get to Dion in a minute because of the USC game. And I think now we're at a point in the season, even though Georgia's played nobody, I mean nobody they've played, and they're still sitting there atop the polls. And you look around some of these other schools that have played teams, Washington has. They're the highest Pac-12 team that is sitting out there today. And yet, you know, John, I look at their schedule coming down the stretch. They host Oregon on the 14th of October. This week they're in Tucson. Okay, that'll be a litmus test game, I think, for both programs.
Yeah.
Go in and win another run. But they finish up with at USC, hosting Utah, at Oregon State, and the Apple Cup. So we're really not going to know how good Washington is until we get late in the season, even the Oregon game, because that's just a big, bad rivalry. So I'm wondering from your perspective, John, when we look around the Pac-12 at this point of the season, about the quarter pole, is Washington legit? Are they the best team in the Pac-12 from what you've seen so far?
I think right now they probably are. It's a little bit hard to tell. There's so many good teams. I've been most impressed with Washington, Oregon, and Washington State. And we should talk about USC's performance in Tempe and what that told us. But I think the Huskies, they have a great offense. I mean, it might be the best offense, passing offense in the country. And their defense, I think, is pretty good. So to me, I've had them as the highest ranked Pac-12 team in my AP ballot all season. I picked them to win the conference back in January, and there's nothing that has caused me to rethink that whole approach. But you're right. Their schedule is loaded in the second half. The conference got lucky in that, you know, the schedule is based on the old division format.
Right.
And the North Division is very good, and Washington also has USC this year. So they're playing, all the good teams are playing each other. Last year, Oregon and Washington didn't play USC. This year they are. And then you throw Utah in the mix, and the second half is going to have one big game after another, and the Huskies are going to be right in the middle of those showcases. They got a primetime game basically every week. So we will, starting on the 14th against Oregon, we'll know, but I think they are very legit.
Okay, a year ago, Caleb Williams wins the Heisman Trophy, but he's at USC. He's in a huge media market. I'll go back to Christian McCaffrey getting hosed, for lack of a better term, on a Heisman. Is Michael Penix in that same boat? He's up in the Pacific Northwest. Yes, they're having a great season, but is the lack of national exposure going to hurt him when it gets into Heisman voting time, from your view?
I do not think so, for a couple reasons. One is that Penix started the season as a national name because he had such a great year. Washington, you know, finished with 11 wins. They beat Texas. Penix was a leading passer in the country. So he started the season with some national name recognition. He was on, you know, if you had looked at preseason Heisman betting odds, he was in the top 10. So he started on the stage. McCaffrey, the year before McCaffrey had his breakout year when he broke Barry Sanders' record, McCaffrey didn't play. Stanford didn't barely put him on the field. So he was, nobody knew him. Mm. Penix has name recognition as his foundation. Plus, you know, they went to Michigan State, they into Big Ten territory, and he put up 4 touchdowns in the first half in a blowout. He is right now, right there with Williams as the betting favorite. So I think he has, and he's going to have plenty of primetime games. McCaffrey played most of his games. 55% of McCaffrey's all-purpose yards that year were on games that started after 10 o'clock Eastern. Mm. Penix is going to have plenty of primetime games. Michigan State, the Oregon game will be primetime. he's not going to have a problem. His only issue is going to be performance. It's not going to be an exposure piece.
Is this a litmus test for Arizona meeting Washington, hosting Washington this Saturday night, just to see where Jed Fish is? The record's impressive. Narrow defeat against Mississippi State. You can make the argument they'd be undefeated at this point. But just from a U of A standpoint, John, what are you seeing?
Yeah, they're very close to being 4-0. They're also very close to being 2-2 with a bad loss to Stanford. So, you know, I have seen a pretty good defense and an offense that isn't quite, you know, for a variety of reasons, not quite what I had expected. I think it's certainly Washington has a potential to go in there and blow their doors off, right? But I kind of think Arizona's going to play them pretty tight. I don't know about Delora's injury. We'll see, you know, if he's healthy. But I also think it's a test for Washington because they have not played great in Tucson. They went down there three or four years pre-pandemic, and that was a tight game. They needed a fumble, recover a fumble in the fourth quarter to survive. They haven't always played great in the desert at ASU either. So we'll see. I think it's going to be very interesting from both sides.
They have a bye the following week, then the USC game. So there's no trap game you can talk about here. It's just getting it taken care of. John Woolner with us for a couple of minutes. You mentioned it earlier. USC didn't look great, or did Kenny Dillingham look that good calling plays? And USC ran into a team that was motivated. Was USC looking ahead to Colorado? There's a lot of ways you could go on this one.
Yeah, I would prefer to take the complexity angle, which is it's more than one thing. USC did not play very well. They clearly, you know, coming off the bye, coming off those easy early wins, and then with the Colorado game next week, I think USC was not totally locked in. But I also think ASU played fantastic given the circumstances, obviously highly motivated off that shutout loss to Fresno State, highly motivated with SC in town. You know, Dillingham did a very nice job getting his guys ready to play despite their beleaguered, depleted state, you know, so both. I think it was both. ASU played very well and USC didn't play very well.
USC, Colorado. Okay, so Colorado gets their doors blown off, and I don't think anybody was surprised by that. Is this the spiral? Is this the whole angle? Can they bounce back? It's the early morning start time with body clocks. I think there's a lot of intrigue once again around this game.
A lot of intrigue. And you know, kudos to USC. They had to agree, the Pac-12 contract states that if you're not going to play, that any game starts before 11 a.m. local, the opposing school has to agree to the start time. So credit USC for agreeing to play a 9 a.m. Pacific game, right? They, you know, Fox, Big Noon, certainly all eyes on the game. I thought it was great that USC agreed to it. And it's going to be a very good test for both teams. I mean, SC's schedule's ASU is the best team that USC has played. They played Nevada, San Jose State, Stanford, and ASU. They haven't played anybody. Colorado has played a much tougher schedule. I think it's going to be a close game. I think Colorado will do much better than it did in Eugene. And I think USC will play better than it did against ASU. But it should be a tough game. And I would not be surprised if Colorado pulls an upset. I am not totally sold on the Trojans yet. I need to see them win some games against some top-tier opponents.
Dan Lanning's team just goes and takes care of business and steamrolls them, and now it's back to the biggest game of the year on Fox, Colorado against USC. Utah, they take care of business against UCLA.
Yep.
Not a peep about where Utah is at this point of the season.
No, but that's very Utah.
It's very Utah, it is. So, you know, what do you make out of just the spotlight being taken away from those programs and, you know, Dan Lanning's comments about clicks versus wins was perfect. You can make that argument in our business, you know? I mean,
it's absolutely. True. But it's also there. It's a little bit, you know, ironic, right? I mean, which school has benefited the most from pomp, circumstance, flash, and show than Oregon, right? You got 1,000 different uniform combinations. But, you know, Lanning's point was well taken, that Colorado has attracted so much attention. And I think that that is serving to motivate Colorado's opponents, right? SC is going to go in there much more motivated to play Colorado than it would have if they didn't have Dion and all these TV televised games on Fox and all this national attention. So It is in some ways it's great for Colorado, but it's also making their challenge more difficult because nobody's going to be overlooking them. They were 1-11 last year. Right. Nobody is going to be looking past them. So, I mean, regardless of who they play, the opponent is going to look at themselves as the one that's getting lack of respect compared to Colorado. And that's going to make it that much more difficult for the Buffs, who obviously have some very good players, but also some major personnel deficiencies. They are not very good on the lines of scrimmage. We knew that going in. That's going to be a problem against all the top teams in the conference.
I'll let you go off that. Good stuff as always. Have a great week.
Thanks very much, Brett.
There's John Wilner, Wilner Hotline, with us week in and week out. And we're back with more after this timeout. All right, let's turn our attention to the biggest story worldwide, and that is the Ryder Cup. It is this week. Bob Herrig with SI.com. It's always good to catch up with Bob. He is there in Rome getting ready, taking a couple of minutes of his time from the press room all around the USA and the Europeans. Good to see you. How is Rome?
Well, I haven't seen a whole lot of it yet, Brad. But from what I've seen, it's very nice, and the weather's great, you know. Kind of used to be in Chile at Ryder Cups, but I don't think that's going to be the case this week. It's pretty nice weather, and it looks like it's going to be all week, you know, sunny, 80s, high 70s, you know. It's kind of I think the stuff we want.
Bob, let's just go through this very basic for the fans. This course that they're playing at, if you could give a thumbnail on the course itself and what they're going to see this week.
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's a course that hosts the Italian Open for the last couple of years, Marco Simone Golf Club. You know, from my understanding is, I mean, if you were just rating golf courses, it's not going to wow anybody in terms of, you know, beauty or difficulty or, you know, any of the things that we sort of look at normally for golf. But it is hilly. It's a difficult walk. I think fitness is going to matter. It might impact whether captains play a guy all five sessions or want to sit him. It's also got some drivable par fours. I mean, it's often been said about the Ryder Cup, you could put 18 holes in a concrete parking lot and it's still going to be compelling because it's match play. And the Ryder Cup isn't so much about, you know, beating the course as it is just beating your opponent. And so I don't necessarily think anybody's going to be, you know, impressed visually by it so much. They'll be impressed by the scene. You know, there's going to be thousands upon thousands of people out there. The first tee setup looks terrific. As usual, you know, it's almost like, you know, it's the Roman Colosseum, you know, sort of the gladiator like look. And I think, you know, that's what we like in a Ryder Cup.
There's been questions and a lot of them about Scottie Scheffler's putting, Justin Thomas being on the team, so on. To you, Bob, you're there. What are the biggest questions on the USA side coming into this week?
I think it's putting in general, frankly. You know, you touched on it there, you know, anecdotally in the Ryder Cup, the U.S. just doesn't seem to make enough putts. It's always been their sort of, you know, their fatal flaw. You know, you can go back and look at some of the stats and how many times, you know, the U.S. goes to the 18th tee, you know, tied or one down or one up and loses the hole, which obviously changes everything. You know, if you're one down and don't win the hole, you've lost. If you're even and you lose the hole or even tie the hole, that's the potential for a half point more. You know, obviously, if you are leading and lose, you've either given up a half point or possibly a whole point if you were behind. And a lot of that's down to the putting. The U.S. just doesn't make putts. You pointed out a couple of guys, Scheffler, JT not putting great. You know, a lot JT had issues beyond putting, but generally that's been the weakness of his game. Scheffler had he had a tiger like year, ball striking and scoring, and yet won just twice, hasn't won since the Players. You know, you've got to look at some of that has to be down to putts when he was so close in so many tournaments. And then, you know, you've got a couple other guys. Morikawa is not really a strong putter. Ricky Fowler's been signed at kind of, you know, he's sort of streaky with the putter. Spieth has not putted great because he hasn't won all year. So, you know, I think it's can they make putts? And I think during the practice rounds, it'll be interesting to see how they look at this. I mean, how much time do they spend practicing putting, reading putts, getting with their caddies to read putts? Because it's such a crucial part of this.
How much of this event, we're talking with Bob Herrick, who joins us from Rome. He is there with SI.com, Sports Illustrated. Always good to have Bob on to chop it up on golf. He's at the Ryder Cup, joining us across the pond for a few minutes. How much of it, Bob, when you cover these, is the mental makeup of the guy? There's so much about the mental side of golf, and yet here we are in this enormous pressure-packed deal representing your country, and if it comes down to hitting a six-foot putt to win the whole deal, and the mental makeup of this this USA team, because we can look at the endorsements, we can look at who's won, we can look at who trends on Twitter and all that stuff. At the end of the day, is this a tough enough, mentally tough team?
Yeah, it's a great question, too, because, you know, what got these guys here is stroke play golf. That's what they play almost exclusively. And now you come into this atmosphere where it's match play. It's 18-hole match play. It's one match at a time. You're not building for the next day or the third day.
Right.
You know, when that 18 holes is over, it's over. You've either won or lost or tied. Those first 2 days, you have a partner. You're also playing a format for eight matches, two different sessions. They're going to be in the mornings, Friday morning and Saturday morning, of foursomes, which is alternate shot. That's something that you just don't see very often. It's not done at the competitive level except in these team competitions. And really, in not very many places in the world do people play alternate shot. So you have situations where a guy might go three or four holes without hitting a putt. He might go long stretches without hitting a mid iron because of the way it worked out. If he's hitting, you know, a short tee shot off a par three, the next hole he's not driving, and so his partner's driving, and so now all of a sudden he's gone a few holes without hitting a driver, you know, and so now he's got to step up on a par five and hit a driver when he hasn't hit one for four holes. There's so much of that, and there is a mental strain there. But I think to your bigger question, just the mental makeup, I mean, it's a different kind of pressure. You're playing for your teammates, for your country. You don't want to let anybody down. You've got 20,000 people bearing down on you, 30,000 people from the get-go. From the moment you stick the tee in the ground, the atmosphere is intense. And, you know, a lot of guys have talked about how much harder it is to hit a tee shot in the Ryder Cup than it even is in a major. So, typically they settle down. They're pro golfers. They're used to playing under pressure. They're used to playing under big moments. But it just seems to refine it that much more at the Ryder Cup.
A couple other questions. I'll let you go and appreciate your time joining us from Rome at the Ryder Cup. Bob Herrick, SI.com. Who's the wild card, or is there one in the USA roster?
You know what? I think it's Wyndham Clark, the U.S. Open champion. Never played in a Ryder Cup or President's Cup. Hasn't played a lot of team golf, really, this kind of team golf. I don't think Wyndham ever played in a Walker Cup.
Yes.
You know, so like at least Brian Harman, who's also new to this, played in Walker Cups back in his college days. And college golf isn't formatted like where you have a partner. You're playing individual golf as a team. So I think he's important because he's obviously a great player. He's got a lot of confidence in himself. You know, the other day he talked about he was very, very reverential towards Rory, gave him all kinds of props. He said, I would really, really love to play against him. Mm. I mean, he wasn't knocking Rory at all. He was saying, I want to put my game up against him. You know, obviously, Rory finished second him at the U.S. Open this year. So I think he is a little bit of their wild card. I mean, he's a rookie, never played in a Ryder Cup, obviously. Playing on the road in this atmosphere, how does he handle it? I mean, you know he's going to be out there. He has to be. Everybody's going to play the first 2 days. There's nobody that's going to sit. You know, you've got to get these guys in there. Otherwise, they're going to be no good on Sunday. And then how does he handle the Sunday single? So, you know, there's been so much talk about the picks. But what about the guys who made it? You know, Wyndham Clark made it. Brian Harman made it. They won majors. They've never played in this before, either President's Cup or Ryder Cup. You just don't know how they're going to do.
You talk about who makes the picks. These two captains, you got a thought on both of them?
Listen, I think they've handled it just fine to this point. You know, they've been getting some heat for their picks. Look, if you don't make the team, which is six guys on each team now, automatically, then you have no gripe. You had an opportunity to make the team. What's the point of having the picks if you're just going to pick off a list of results? Mm-hmm. The idea is to give yourself the opportunity to mold your team, to find partnerships. I think both captains have done this. That was what their attempt was. And on the U.S. side, I find it particularly interesting that Zach's been criticized for this. This isn't to say he made the right decisions, but clearly they have analytics. They've been studying this. He has assistants. Back in the day when the U.S. was struggling so much in the Ryder Cup, the complaint was, hey, it's a bunch of individuals and they're not a team. And clearly you can't just throw great individuals out there to win. Well, now he's trying to mold a team and he's getting criticized for it. I think we have to see how it plays out. I think when it all gets started, we're going to see some pretty obvious teams that he puts together based on the fact that that's who we wanted together out there.
And last question, it's, you know, the United States is playing overseas. They don't do well overseas. Do you think they break it this time? Do you think they push through? You got a prediction on this, Bob? Or are you not in the prediction business?
Actually, I do. I think there's two things we haven't seen lately. The U.S. hasn't won over here in 30 years, which is, you know, kind of defies belief, really. That's six Ryder Cups that they have not been able to win with typically the more experienced or the favored team, you know. And the other thing is we haven't had a particularly close Ryder Cup, certainly not coming down right to the end, since 2012, you know, 11 years ago. You know, the outcomes have been, you know, the outcome has been 5 points, which, you know, that's only like two or three matches, but still, the last one was a 10-point win. It's five. You know, the Europeans had virtually no chance on Sunday 2 years ago at Whistling Straits. I think it's going to be closer. I think we might have one that comes right down to the end.
I'll let you go off that. I appreciate your time. Enjoy the week. Thanks.
Thanks, Brad.
Over in Rome, there's Bob Herrick. Follow his content, sportsillustratedsi.com. You can follow him on social media platforms. Make sure you support what he does. He does great work. And we're back with more after this timeout. All right. As you can tell, we've done things a little backwards today with timing of guests and all of that stuff. That's part of the show. Thanks again to John Wilner. And thanks again for being with us in things that we do across the fruited plain in the world of sports. Bob Herrick joining us from Rome with the timing of that as well. Jared Nielsen is our chairman of the board. Our opening comments, I'm going to get into some stuff here before we get out of here. Opening comments are brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, as always, taking care of you, taking care of your business. That is Desert Financial Credit Union. We appreciate their support. On this Monday, the Diamondbacks are winning right now in New York, and I'm leading with them rather than the Cardinals because this is the timely time of the show. Six games left in the regular season after today, and the Diamondbacks are in a space where it's looking very much like we're going to have postseason baseball. If you think about it, seven games counting today. Merrill Kelly will get another start. Zach Gallen will get another start in those six games. So that leaves four games. And you've got to rely on Brandon Pfaadt or Zach Davies or a bullpen by committee a couple of times or, you know, four times. I think it's got to be like 4-2 and you're in. Because the teams behind them keep winning. They're not going to catch the Phillies. And they have an advantage for the second wild card spot. Today, as we sit here and we speak, and they're winning again at New York. I think it's been a blessing, actually, that they had a rain out because the bullpen should be fully rested, fully ready to go this week. It's going to be a heavy bullpen week, I would think. They go from New York, they go to Chicago, they meet the White Sox, who stink, and then they have Houston, and Houston's still going to be playing for something. So those three games this coming weekend are going to be lights out. They will. And you'd like to have it all wrapped up before you even get to those games. Just, okay. We're in the second wild card position or even the third card. We know we're in. And then, you know, if you're able to be in a space where Zach or Merrill do not have to pitch, this coming weekend, then you're ready to go for the postseason. That's how I look at it, at least. You know, the Cardinal game yesterday, we're going to get to a point here in the Valley. I don't know when it's going to be. I've been here for over 30 years. So the conversation usually on NFL Mondays revolves around the Cardinals are losing or lost, and the other team's fans outnumber them by, you know, X amount, exponentially. Yesterday, the Cowboy fans, from the people I talked to that were there in the stadium, it was 80 to 85% Cowboy fans. And I listened to the call-in show after the game was over, and people were talking about how fans shouldn't sell their tickets, and oh my gosh. And there's very little about, hey, this is really interesting to see how Joshua Dobbs has come in here and how he's been able to put this team on his back, basically. They could be 3-0. I'm not saying they should be. I'm saying they could be. They're about five plays away from being in a position of being 3-0. They are. And you could make the argument that they've made significant progress. I just look at things like week to week, they've gotten better. And in the NFL, it is when you play a team. It is when you catch a team. It is, especially early in the season. When you catch a team like Dallas and they've been through a bunch of stuff off the field, they lose one of their top players. It's just human nature. When you look at the schedule and they have a big nationally broadcast game against New England the following week, it's a trip out to Arizona. Okay, yeah, we'll get through it. And they don't. I'm not besmirching or taking away anything from what the Cardinals did. But if you look at when you catch a team, like the Cardinals have to go to San Francisco next week. San Francisco's had some extended rest. The game's at home. San Francisco should be favored to win that game. Should be. Doesn't mean they will. You can't really predict the NFL. How many of you had 70 for the Miami Dolphins yesterday? How many? Of course, how many of you had Taylor Swift showing up at the Kansas City game? And I was going to try to make it through a show without making a reference, but I think just basically had to. So it's a great win for the Cardinals and for where they are with their new coach and their general manager, and some validation that they're doing the right things. James Conner looks as fresh and as good as any running back in the NFL right now. He does. Can the Cardinals find ways to shore up where the injuries are starting to happen? I think Jonathan Gannon is talking this afternoon. I don't know about Zaven Collins. I don't know the severity of it, but how much depth do they really have on this team? You know, they win a game without their best defensive player, Buda Baker, even on the field. It's a tremendous, tremendous step forward for them. I'm not taking anything away from it. So, but the question about Joshua Dobbs versus Kyler Murray is not one that I think is relevant today. Today. But as the next few weeks progress, okay, what does 2024 look like? The whole idea of tanking right now, doesn't seem plausible. I watched Houston. I found myself watching Houston and Jacksonville yesterday, and I was explaining to my wife, I have to watch Houston because they need to lose because the Cardinals have their first round pick. Like, I never thought I'd be watching Houston against Jacksonville unless I have Travis Etienne on my fantasy team, which I do. And that's as much fantasy as I'm going to give you. Anyways, that was yesterday. On the college scene, man, the amount of people being offended. Ryan Day at Ohio State, just shut up. It's Lou Holtz. My gosh. Washington State, Oregon State. It's Lee Corso. It's two guys that they're being put on the air for things that they've done years and years and years ago on the field. And because everybody's comfortable hearing from Lee Corso on Saturdays. And Lou Holtz, it's Notre Dame. Of course he's going to say things like that. And gosh, the first thing that comes roaring out of Ryan Day's mouth is Lou Holtz and disrespect and all that nonsense. I thought what Dan Lanning said about Colorado chasing clicks, I mean, that happens in our business where crap's thrown out and this person's fired and this is going down and you watch and like, okay, got it. I thought it was a very entertaining Saturday. I watched Clemson and Florida State. I wanted to see if Florida State was real. I wanted to see what Dabo Swinney was going to do. And I saw Dabo Swinney make so many boneheaded, and his staff, so many just terrible, terrible, horrible decisions in coaching and clock management. I mean, like, who are these people? What are you guys doing? And if you're a Clemson fan or you watch the game, you know exactly how many times Clemson had a chance to win the game. And instead, they crapped all over themselves. It was just dreadful. Colorado goes to Oregon. No surprise they get blown out. Who's the best team within the conference right now? As we talked about with John Wilner, may well be Washington. Most of all, I'm excited for the Ryder Cup this week. I am one of those people that is into, I'm not great at golf. I love going out and playing and just my first channel if this is not decided on Sunday. That's why God made a DVR. It's a beautiful invention. I will not be watching Arizona State and Cal this Saturday. Jordan Hamm will be there at Berkeley. This is why God made a DVR. There's lots of great inventions that God created for a guy like me that has to watch, go to events. And it's a great time of year. You know, you get into late September. A week from today, we're going to be down at the Suns. Suns open up their training camp next Monday. It's their media day. And then you get in the baseball playoffs. I think we're going to have Diamondback playoffs and everything in October. October is just a mess. There's so much going on. So, and that's that. Jared Nielsen is our chairman of the board. We appreciate him. I am Brad Sussmat. This show repeats and repeats and repeats. If you missed any part of Bob Herrig from Rome at the Ryder Cup or John Wilner, it repeats here in a few moments.